Without wishing to be too ironic, you're comparing apples and oranges.
Like, you set him up, he'll knock him down. Listeners, and welcome to season 2, episode 52 of a show that we'd like to call Bad Voltage.
Yeah, it's mostly hanging together as Bad Voltage. It's been a bit of a riotous recording session today.
Has been a riotous recording session.
Well, what threw us off kilter was the fact that we agreed to move the recording time for the show, and then one member of the team who shall remain unnamed, who is currently situated in Buffalo.
Technically unnamed.
That was the remove.
You know,
like the remix is also often not better.
You know when people say, I don't think, yes, fine, Google, keep my data secret, but they happen to let on where I was and who I talked to and who I was with at the time. But everyone goes, no, that's not what they're talking about. This is what they mean, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that person showed up half an hour late to the show, despite us having a conversation yesterday about moving it. But never mind. This is not necessarily all about his character, professionalism, and dignity.
Wow.
Let's get on with
the
show.
I'll tell you what. If you look up the words unfairly accused in the dictionary, there is a picture of Jeremy right next to him looking exactly as he does now.
Well, I was looking back to see if I missed something, and no, I didn't.
You know what you did miss? The calendar entry moving to the correct time slot. Anyway.
Given your affinity for calendar moves and Axe's inability to understand time zones, the calendar event is almost inconsequential.
It is actually a good point. Bloke, if we didn't move that calendar entry, it would have made no difference whatsoever when we record the
Bloke
show.
Makes a point, I have
anyway,
to say.
So anyways, back to the glory of episode 52. What are we talking about today?
So I want to talk about open source, right? Because we never talk about that.
Some
thoughts on fairness and unfairness and taking other people's software and using it and selling it and so on and so forth. And I want to get your opinions because I'm not sure what I think.
Yeah, and it's actually got quite a bit of meat in that segment, so I'm looking forward to getting into that. But before we get into that, we're going to do a little bit of news. We don't have a huge amount of time, but we wanted to squeeze in some news nuggets. Can I kick off, gentlemen?
News nuggets must go first.
News nuggets must go first. That's the rule. I don't make the rules. So did you see that Lenovo are releasing a new ThinkPad as part of the X1 line? And it is a foldable PC. And it literally looks like, you know that, what was it? Like the Galaxy Mate or whatever it's called. CGA.
The Galaxy Fold. Yeah, it's basically... A big fold.
It's like it's a massive version of the Galaxy Fold. Now, the Lenovo people, if they were listening to this show, which they're almost certainly not, would be quite annoyed at that description. But it looks frankly ridiculous. And
on the other hand, the chap from Lenovo who gave all the interviews about this, their marketing director, would be considerably more annoyed at what I called him off air when I first read this story. So
it wasn't a pleasant way of describing him.
It is for people who haven't seen this, and there'll be a link in the show notes. It's basically a big screen that folds in half like the Galaxy Fold does. So there's no keyboard or anything. It's just a screen.
It seems more plausible than the Samsung, though. No.
Why?
Why?
Because a larger form factor enables you to do things that are like the dynamics of a phone. It's already impressive what they can cram into a phone. Cramming a foldable screen is just adding one more thing to an already massively over-engineered device where fractions of millimeters matter. On a laptop, you have a lot of flexibility as far as where you can put components, where you can do other things, how the screen can be organized. I mean, I'm not saying I want one or it's necessarily useful as designed in this particular case, but it seems to me from a design and... actually shipping a product perspective, it seems more plausible that a foldable screen on a laptop will be a thing that happens than a phone.
Boom! The fact that something is easy to build for the developer does not mean that that's a good reason to build it.
I didn't say that. I said plausible to build, not will be a massive seller and is an awesome thing. I mean, it looks... I'm intrigued by the look. I don't know...
cannot believe a man of your integrity
why
and intellect.
I don't know why someone would buy this.
It hasn't got a keyboard. You have to type on a screen, but you're taking the one thing which is good about laptops, that they have a keyboard built in, and taking it away.
Well, now, we were talking about this before we recorded, when Jeremy was half an hour late to the recording session. and we turned into those two old guys on the Muppet Show, and we were talking about, you need a tactile keyboard. But maybe, today, so many people are used to typing on their screens and iPads. I see iPads everywhere, people tapping on them. Maybe people don't need that as much anymore. Maybe this is a dated perspective about the tactile keyboard.
I think if you're Ack or me or even you, we type enough. That.
What do you mean, or even you?
I mean, Xcode all day, I'm working all day.
Jono, I mean, admittedly, if we cut off his index finger, he wouldn't know how to read anymore. But nonetheless.
But I think for some subset of people, they don't type enough where it would be a huge issue.
Right.
Where I would be supremely annoyed typing out a piece
but
of text.
I don't understand why someone who is like that, someone who feels comfortable typing on an Android tablet or an Apple tablet, right? So they haven't got out and got one of the little foldable plug-in keyboards or whatever. So most of the people I know who actually do typing on, they say, oh, I only use an iPad, I don't use a laptop. You go, but yeah, you've got a portable keyboard. It just is a laptop, it's just in two bits, right? But people who are used to typing on this, people who are okay with the stupid ZX81 concept of typing on a flat screen, how many of them need basically a double size iPad that folds in half rather than just the iPad they've got already? It gives you the benefit that you've got twice as big a screen. And as far as I can tell, they haven't really cracked folding technology yet, because you get a big divot where it is, and it looks like there's a screen protector on it. Did you see this? The screen protector thing.
No.
Right? No. Bunch of people who got the Galaxy Fold. When you actually look at the folded bit in the middle, the curved bit of the screen, it looks like there's a screen protector on it. But it isn't. It's a critically important integral part of the screen. So people try to peel it off thinking, I don't want a screen protector on it. And it's like peeling the cornea off the front of your eyes. Right? So you can peel this thing up about half an inch and then the whole screen fritzes out in snow. Right? It's hilarious.
That is quite funny.
Lots of people are like, I can't believe it. I peeled the screen protector off and the screen stopped working. And all the people at Samsung are like, dude, you peeled the front off the screen. Don't do that. But anyway, I'm not seeing who the market for this thing is. Although the chap describing it said that the market is highly mobile, tech-savvy executives and business professionals and tech enthusiasts and early adopters, which as far as I can tell is a description of all three of us, and none of us want it, Lenovo. Don't build this stupid product.
I can see it being interesting in design environments where your laptop could fold down, you could use it as a big screen for like drawing with a pencil. Can you imagine also laying it down and playing a virtual board game? That'd be kind of cool. But anyway, whatever. Let's move on. We haven't got much time. Come on, Jeremy, give us something.
There's a couple interesting things here, but let's go with the... I'm sure that you both saw the Uber IPO.
I watched it closely, my friend.
There's a little bit of a prediction riding on this, I understand. But
yes.
For the actual IPO, right, they were talking about initially it being about $120 billion IPO. It was going to be the IPO to end all IPOs, the biggest IPO ever. There's all kinds of things going into it. They ended up IPOing at $45 a share, which was about $82.5 billion. It never went to $45. It immediately went down, and it's down almost 20% in the last 2 days of trading. Where it will be when the show goes live in a couple of days, obviously not knowable. But the fact that they lost 20% in 2 days leaves a ton of employees' options underwater. So I'm sure the morale there is a little bit grim. It's getting so bad that now people are blaming Morgan Stanley, saying they didn't do a good job predicting a bunch of different things related to the IPO. Depending on how you rate these things, and because you can go by percentage of the company or straight dollars, et cetera, one of the worst IPOs of all time by some specific measurements. So especially being in the valley there, Jono, what do you think of this?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I haven't really been paying much attention to it, and I don't quite understand everything that's going on right now. But it doesn't seem great. All I know is that my prediction is rapidly coming true.
Nah, and that's not so, sir. You predicted that Uber would IPO, and they would be the biggest IPO ever.
I think that was a bonus.
And they were the ninth biggest IPO ever, which is pretty big. Don't get me wrong. Well, I haven't got a top 10 IPO company, admittedly. But the eighth
I think I said something along the lines of, this isn't part of the prediction, but I suspect they will be the biggest one.
I'm on five, and we're already quibbling over prediction details.
I confess, I did go back and read the show notes, but I didn't actually listen to the show. So we will do that at the end of the year, but nonetheless. So yeah, so they IPO'd, but behind Kraft.
Right.
on the other hand, if you got a Kraft cheese slice and gave it a copy of Google Maps and told it to drive me around town, it'd probably do approximately as well. So that'd be fine.
Still not a fan of Uber, are
Still
you?
Not a fan of Uber.
All right, well, give us something to smile about then. What have you got?
Did you see that? Well, smiling's probably not quite the right word. Either of you two use WhatsApp?
Not anymore.
I thought this was interesting. Fine, WhatsApp got hacked. But what it actually was someone worked out a way to place a call through WhatsApp and then essentially deliver a payload. And then as soon as the call arrived on the other end, it looks like it was something like a buffer overflow. And so it would basically deploy software on that remote machine. Lol. Yeah. One of the things I thought was interesting about this was that they didn't mention it in the release notes. When they put out the new fix, they didn't even mention, oh my God, world's biggest security hole or anything. You know, they changed the logo to a coach and horses or something.
Right.
But literally just before we came on air, I saw a hot take on this, which was someone saying...
all right, Andy Crane.
I'm honestly not really sure what a hot take is. People talk about them a lot, but I don't know whether it's meant to be a good thing or not. They were saying...
I can get off my lawn comment in 8 seconds.
I know, right? It is, old man yells at cloud. It's terrible. But what they were saying was... the reason you don't talk about this stuff is that people won't install stuff for security reasons. They will install stuff for feature reasons. And this is why, for example, Apple put out new emoji in point releases, because people upgrade to get the new emoji and therefore just get all the security stuff, which I think is not a bad explanation for some things, but it seems a bit disingenuous to not even mention the fact that if you don't upgrade, you could be owned brutally with this.
Yeah, certainly not how I want my security updates communicated, but...
No, but then you're not using WhatsApp, right?
I am not.
And there it is.
Although I do use Unify stuff, and the latest release note said, security improvement, asterisk, an advisory and CVE will be made available soon. So...
Ooh!
Oh, good.
That's not much better.
On the other hand, this means that someone has advised them of a problem. They have
fixed it
first, deployed the fix, and will then release the information publicly. That's what we want to happen, right? Presumably paying someone
also,
a bug bounty.
Also, if you're using Unify stuff, upgrade right now.
Yeah, do that immediately. Coming. But anyway, yes, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, I have one that's very quick, as we're almost out of time. Apparently, a research study was done recently into the effects of alcohol, of coffee, specifically caffeine within coffee, on your health. And they came back with this zinger of a conclusion that apparently, if you drink more than 6 cups of coffee a day, it can be detrimental to your health. Who would have thunk it, eh? So, don't drink more than 6 cups of coffee a day.
Seems like a lot of coffee. And I drink a fair amount of coffee, but that seems excessive.
How many a day, Jeremy, would you say?
Probably 2 or 3 decent-sized mugs.
Right. Because I do one in the morning that's full caffeine, and then I switch to half-caf or decaf for the rest of the day. Caffeine is not good. It's not good for your body.
I agree entirely.
Langridge hates coffee.
Just don't drink coffee. It's the easiest thing. You drink as much tea as you like.
But how many teas do you drink in a day?
Yeah, he drinks 900 cups of tea.
Yeah. So. Maybe not 900, but 9 is perfectly reasonable amount of tea to drink, in my opinion. Why would you not want to drink tea? Right.
No, I like tea. I mean, I'm drinking a tea right now. I just, 9 cups of black tea seems like amount of caffeine.
It's fab. You know, Google I.O. just happened, right?
It did, yeah.
One of the things that got demonstrated on stage, a very cool thing called prox.app, which is it's basically a very pretty port of essentially Minesweeper to the web. But it was done by some of the people on the Google web team as part of, the Chrome DevRel team, as part of a way of demonstrating, look, it's possible to build really cool games on the web that load really fast, don't use a lot of storage, space, whatever. Okay.
Is implementing Minesweeper for the web today considered a technological interesting use case?
No, the point is, it's pretty and didn't take them that long.
Okay.
But
okay, fair enough.
What's interesting is, obviously, they went, okay, here it is, open source on GitHub, MIT license, no problem.
Yep.
And then, within about 48 hours, I think, some random person had taken that, bundled it up into an app, and put it on the iOS and Android stores for $2.
Yeah.
And there was kind of a response from Surma, one of the team, going, oh, that's a bit crap. And a lot of the people responding to him were kind of, yeah, should they be allowed to do that? That's not very fair. And what I thought was interesting about that was there is this hugely prevailing sentiment that it genuinely isn't very fair. Now, this discussion has been going on, to be clear, an open source license permits people to do this. And
yes,
it always has done. And historically, when this discussion came up in, 2003 or whatever, where someone would say, I released a piece of open source software and then someone made CDs of it and sold them on eBay, that's not fair. Someone would go, no, actually, it's allowed. And they go, oh, okay, never mind then. What's happening now increasingly as open source gets more and more popular and becomes more and more the default standard rather than explicit choice by people, we're increasingly seeing, I think, people saying this is not fair, and the prevailing sentiment is, yeah, it isn't very fair. And if that happens to individual people, then they feel a bit resentful. And if it happens to a big company like MongoDB, then they try and come up with some mad license to prevent it from happening. But it all seems like a similar problem.
But hang on a second. Hang on. One quick question on that. You used the word fair a few times. How is it not fair?
What I'm trying to get across is people do not think that it is fair. What I want to talk about here, because I don't know the answer, is historically, someone has said, that's not very fair. I did all the work to build this thing. You put in almost no effort and you get all the money for it. And the response has been, that's what open source allows. If you don't like it, shouldn't have picked open source in the first place. Which is the truth, but lacks something in bedside manner, right? But
that's a nice way of describing it, like something in bedside manner. I like
but
that.
Historically, again, there weren't that many people writing open source software, and even if there were, taking it and selling it wasn't that big a business because there weren't that many people who wanted to buy it either. Now, as I say, because a lot of people choosing open source are doing so because it's kind of the default for their industry, or because open source has won, depending on how flag-flying you want to be about it, and because they haven't grown out of an open source mindset, if someone says, hey, I feel like I've been screwed by this, we, the open source community, don't seem to be very good at explaining to them this is why it is. But what I don't know is the fix for this that we get better at explaining why it's important that the stuff that they've built can be sold by someone else? Or does open source itself need to evolve into a way where maybe that isn't allowed, which is what MongoDB are trying to do? Or should we be saying to people, if that bothers you, get trademarks on things? Or what? I don't know but I feel like the traditional response of just going, well, suck it up. That's what open source allows, Buttercup. Seems a bit chilly, if nothing else.
So I think the case of Mongo and Redis and those versus someone selling open source software like VLC or LibreOffice on eBay are two different issues. But for the latter one, which is the one you initially brought up, I actually don't think it's more prevalent now. I think it's less prevalent now than it was back in the day, just because I think it was easier to do back in the day because less people really knew what OpenOffice, which is the first one I remember it being really rampant, was. So it was easier to just make a copy, act like it was commercial software, and sell it on eBay, where now I think most people have at least heard of LibreOffice in some way, shape, or form. But for those cases, I think as long as you are abiding by the terms of the license, and if it's permissively licensed, that's not very onerous. You kept saying fair. I think it probably isn't fair, but it's definitely legal, right? Yeah. And that's where the bar for this is.
I am in no way disputing the legality of it. Yes, it's perfectly legal to do this. What I don't like is people get upset by it, and they're the people we want to keep sweet, right? Given two communities, one who writes software and one who takes other people's software and just sells it on CDs on eBay or sells it on the App Store with almost no effort. If you want to keep one of those communities sweet, it's the one who's doing all the writing, right?
I would agree with that. I think that the larger projects like LibreOffice or VLC have the tools to stop it because they probably already have a trademark and can defend it and should defend it. I think smaller projects probably don't have a real recourse against this. And I guess part of it is, I think for smaller individual projects, understanding what open source is, what licenses mean, and how open sourcing it impacts what you do is important. And we're moving away from a day where people care about that, at least anecdotally to me. And I could, that just could be my perception of things. But I think when I first got into open source a while ago, most people that open source things did so for philosophical reasons, kind of understood licensing, at least at a base level, and at least understood like copyleft versus not copyleft, et cetera. They might not have known the details between specific licenses, but they, in broad strokes, understood licensing. Now, I think most people that throw things up on GitHub, and this is a pretty well-known problem, have no idea and just are like, whatever, I'll open source it, without really thinking through the implications of what that means or what choosing different licenses means for them as a project, because different licenses have different advantages and different disadvantages, and you need to understand those, I think, which I don't know is as well understood today as it's been in the past.
But isn't that what open? We wanted open source to win, right? And surely winning means everybody's using it. And that by definition comes with the fact that it's not only the Cognoscenti who are now using it. As something becomes more mass market, it's going to be done by people with less understanding. That's what victory is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the rules of victory were well defined in the beginning, not to cut you off there, John, but I think that's part of the issue here is I think winning means much different things to much different groups of people in the context of open source.
I was going to say something similar. Like, I think that the tricky thing here is we're talking about a variety of different audiences, right? So, like using your example, Ak, of the people who made the Minesweeper proof of concept, if those people didn't know the implications of putting that code online and that it was almost certainly going to be ripped off and sold, then they are woefully naive. Like, they must have known that. Now, I think they're a different audience to Jeremy's example of a lot of people who put code into GitHub and they genuinely really don't know. For example, I suspect there's a lot of students at universities who are producing code as part of their courses and they're sticking it into GitHub without a license and they don't really realize. And a lot of people will take those university projects and build businesses around them later on. And then, of course, another audience is people such as Mongo, where they're just trying to run a business and they just want to be compensated for the investment in it. And the tricky thing in my mind is that, of course, I think where you use the word, I don't want us to get too hung up on the word fair, because I know we all understand that we're not talking about, there's different versions of fair, right? We're not talking about like, yes, it's legally permissible, of course. But there is just the rights and the wrongs of how things are done. And I think what we're really talking about is the difference between availability and sustainability. And that's where Mongo have been moving in that direction, is that they're, I think they were struggling to be able to maintain their business under the terms of the license that they've got. So, you know, I don't know. I think this will always be a problem. You're always going to have this. Because if open source is imperfect, right? It's just
Wow.
You know.
Okay. Not the answer I was expecting.
Out of curiosity, what was the answer you were expecting?
What was the expense?
I was thinking to myself, yeah, we as a community, we're kind of chilly by just saying to people, well, that's the way it is. And if you don't know, then that's your fault for not knowing. And you two have both basically come back and gone, that's the way it is. If you don't know, it's your fault for not knowing. And what I was hoping we might be able to do is suggest that maybe we ought to be better at explaining this or have a better way of phrasing it that people's... I imagine you'd probably both agree that people's intuitive knee-jerk reaction to someone doing this is, that's not fair. Whether they're right to think that or not, that's people's knee-jerk reaction.
I think it depends on the person.
Really?
I think there are a lot of people who will look at that and say, sure. I don't think everybody looks at that and sees that as necessarily unfair. I think people who are much more aligned with the philosophical side of open source and free software may determine that to be unfair. But I think a lot of people will say, this is the reality of the market that we're operating in.
Absolutely disagree with you. I think it's exactly the other way around. Someone who's very aligned with open source would go, no, that's a perfectly reasonable use, because they've come to terms with, embraced the relatively complicated philosophical position that giving stuff away actually does better in the long run. I think if you were to stand on a street corner and give out apples, and someone went, I'll take those apples off you, and then stood next to you and sold the apples for £1 apiece and got loads of business, the people would say, that's not fair. That bloke is taking advantage of your generosity and making money for himself out of it. And then they go, well, that's just the market.
And that, I think, is people's instinctive reaction to this, too. Without wishing to be too ironic, you're comparing apples and oranges. Like,
you set him up, he'll knock him down.
Like, I mean, if
now
if
I wish
if
I'd said ice cream. I was going to say ice cream, but I didn't.
If I gave you some apples, like if I gave you something as a gift and then you went and sold it to somebody else, I would, understandably, my nose would feel a bit pushed out of position, right? But this is, to me, this is a license is, yes, it's a legal contract, right? In of sorts, but it also affords you a set of freedoms. And one of those freedoms may not run with somebody else's definition of the freedom that they want to have, right? Now, all I'm saying is, I don't think the solution to this problem is education, right? Because I think a significant number of people whose software is, to use a bad term, ripped off and sold to other people, but basically when this happens, I think they fully understand the nature of what might happen with those licenses. The question is, how do you make this software sustainable? How do you set it up in a way where you can build free software and you can generate revenue and you can still give it away for free? And sadly, that's way harder than I think any of us would have anticipated. And most open source companies haven't figured that out, certainly. And it certainly is very difficult for small hobbyists or, you know.
So let me ask you both a question, just out of curiosity, where you stand. To use the very specific example that Eck gave to start this segment off, if someone on eBay sells, let's use VLC as an example, if someone sells VLC that is not in any way related to VLC, the project, on eBay for a reasonable fee on CD for those, let's say, that can't download or whatever the excuse may be, let's pick a price that we all agree is pretty low and say $4.
Yep.
If someone does that, do you have an issue with it?
So are you saying that it's not VLC, but it's called VLC?
So it is VLC, but it's not VLC, the project selling it. It's no one involved with VLC.
Okay.
It's just some random person who's not part of the project selling it for $4.
Right.
Is that an issue to you or no?
No.
Specifically that, no. Question, if they were selling it for $24, would you feel the same way? Because I think $4, they're basically, they're providing a service to someone who is unable to download it or wants to be able to buy a CD or something like that. That was always the argument, that you're essentially charging people for the service you're providing of putting on a CD and selling it to them and making a little bit of money for yourself. Not really a problem, right? If they're selling it for $24, I'd think, no, you're just you're basically charging rent for being a middleman, and I don't like that kind of thing. Now, taking someone's application, bundling it up one time into an APK, and then sticking it on the Play Store, at which point every time someone buys it, you get $2, that's like selling a VLC CD for $24 to me. It's not like selling it for four.
But surely if they're selling it for a dollar, let's say they sell it for $2, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. Surely that is them. That is them, that they've invested their time and effort in putting that thing together and making it available. So you basically saying, like, if I understand you correctly, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're basically saying, so long as the total profit from that endeavor reasonably matches the investment, yes, of their time and effort, you're okay, yes, with it. But if it goes significantly beyond, yeah, that, you think that it's unfair.
That's the thing. I don't particularly have a problem with someone saying, I'm going to take the software and then selling it. It's when you're making money disproportionate to your investment.
Hmm.
And I don't even mind if you do a thing, if no one else does a thing, you do a little tiny thing and then you sell it for loads of money, fine. It's when someone else does 90% of the work, you do 1% and then get paid a load of money for it. That's what I don't like.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I'm in two minds about this because I'm...
This is why I brought it up, because I don't know how I feel about this.
I'm separating out, this using the VLC as an example, using that as an example, I'm separating out the sustainability of the VLC project, which is my number one concern,
yep,
and then the free market and what the market will tolerate in terms of distribution, right? Like if someone puts a $24 CD on eBay selling VLC, probably an old version of this VLC, and people pay that, then you're a fucking idiot, right? And you should have done your research better. So I don't have an issue with the principle of people selling stuff. However, I would much rather that $24 be invested into the VLC project, obviously, right? So I have no academic or intellectual objection to the sale of it, but to me, I would worry about
that's
the
kind
impact
of,
on sustainability.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. There's a sort of visceral feeling of, that doesn't seem right. There's some, you know, hand-wavy definition of rightness or fairness or reasonability. I mean, someone selling VLC, in our made-up example, someone selling VLC CDs for $24 and then $20 of that goes back to the VLC project, I wouldn't mind that either.
Yeah,
it's when it feels like, you know, sharecropping, rent seeking, that I don't like it.
Right. Jeremy, what, using your example, what's your take on it?
I think I roughly agree. I was just very quickly browsing to see what the average price for VLC on eBay is, and it seems to run the gamut pretty widely from $3.99 to about $19.99.
Right.
The average looks to be about $8.
Huh. Right.
So, I mean, I think ideally, if people did this, they would donate some back to VLC, and I would have much less of an issue with it if they did that. I don't think most people do that, but once I think as long as they're distributing the license and as long as they're following all of the conditions that they need to follow, I mean, if it were a bigger issue, I'm curious why more open source projects don't go after trademark violations then.
And that's one of the solutions I've seen proposed to this, get this trademarked. And in this particular case, because it was built by the team at Chrome DevRel, they've got trademarks on the names. And they were kind of, and there were some people saying to them, well, yeah, you've got trademarks on the name, so you're fine. And my response to that was, it's not sustainable to have a solution which only applies if you're a big company with a legal team. I can't get trademarks on stuff. It's hard and it costs loads of money.
Well, the trademark thing is a tool for solving this problem, for mitigating this problem. However, most small open source projects do not have a legal entity in which the trademark can be assigned,
right,
and they don't have the dollars to be able to defend this kind of stuff.
No.
And frankly, there is a huge risk of generating the Barbara Streisand effect.
Yes.
Where if you start going after people who are quite legally, like, it, to me, what would I would worry if I was one of these projects that you would have something like what happened with Lars Ulrich and Napster in the early 2000s. Yeah. Like, I remember at the time when he went out. So for younger listeners,
you might want to fill people in who didn't live through this the first time around.
So Lars Ulrich is a fucking terrible drummer who plays for a band called Metallica, and who has a six head as opposed to a forehead. I know I'm one to talk when it comes to foreheads, but someone
once asked if Lars Ulrich was the best drummer in the world, and got the response he's not even the best drummer in Metallica.
Exactly.
Which is not really. I was really joking about Ringo Starr and the Beatles, but I like the joke. So.
Yeah, I like the joke. So he discovered that there was a bunch of Metallica music on the file sharing service Napster, which was one of the first file sharing services or earlier file sharing services back then. And he sued them and he went after them. And I remember reading about this at the time and thinking, seems reasonable.
Wow.
You know, like,
wow, there's a service called Napster where I can download free music. Fantastic.
Right. And I remember actually reading about this while listening to Free Metallica. And
the number of people who discovered the existence of Napster from the fact that that was front page news, wildly outweighed. Yeah, the Barbara Streisand effect, exactly, as you say.
The Streisand effect, which is where when someone tries to stop something, it actually ends up becoming bigger than it should have been. And and Metallica fans and many people like wildly railed against Ulrich and Metallica for doing this. Whereas I think at the time, most people, well, certainly me, I think a lot of people looked at it and were like, well, hang on, you recorded these albums, you put them, you sell them, they're your intellectual property. You're not licensing these as open source. You know, that seems quite reasonable. And, but it had a negative effect. So I think I can imagine an open source project going after someone selling a shitty CD on eBay and it having that kind of effect. So I don't know.
Yeah, totally. This was, I thought it was interesting because my immediate thought was just to say to people suffering this problem, well, you know, it's allowed. That's just one of the things you buy into as part of participating in the open source ecosystem. And then I heard myself saying that, and I thought, that sounds really quite chilly, you know?
Jeremy, stop typing. We're looking at chilly.
And I'd be interested in your... I was interested in your thoughts on it. So this is something where I'm interested in people's opinions generally, and this is therefore a community question, right? People's intuitions about how this should be? How do they resolve those intuitions? What do they propose as solutions?
So... before we wrap up this segment, because I think it's kind of interesting, what if you had to come up with a solution for this? I'm just curious what each of you, if you have one option that you're going to propose within the realistic world that we're operating today, like, so you've got hobbyists, you've got your example of the Minesweeper people, you've got big companies. You want to try and find the right balance for trying. I mean, obviously, there's no single solution for this. I'm not suggesting that there is. But what do you think is the best way to try and mitigate this problem? Because I think we all agree that this is a problem. And we want to make sure that the people building the software are being sustained as best they can. What do you think is the best approach? Like, Ak, you suggested earlier on about maybe this is one about education. But what do you think?
I'm inclined to think that getting a better bedside manner would help here. I mean, to enlarge on that slightly, my immediate response after my knee-jerk reaction of, yeah, that is unfair, and I thought to myself, no, it isn't. The open source license permits it. And what I wanted was a way of saying that without just going, well, it's allowed, you shut up complaining. I wanted a way of saying, no, it's allowed and it's actually a good thing. And if you think about the whole ecosystem and the way it works, any alternative solutions would be more of a problem, whatever. But in a tweet, And I don't have a good explanation for why it's actually a good thing that people are allowed to do this without basically explaining the whole of open source and taking an hour to do it. So
do you feel like people don't know this?
I feel like certainly a lot of people in the web industry where open source is pretty much the norm now haven't grown up as we have with the nuanced philosophical reasoning behind it. Stuff is open source because it's just open. You just put code on GitHub, right? Everyone can use it. It's an understanding of what open source is, but it's a shallow one. Making the argument that giving stuff away is better for that thing generally, that even allowing people to sell software that you built, where they make a bunch of money and you don't, is still better for your software overall, is quite an in-depth, nuanced philosophical argument. And you don't have time to explain that nuanced philosophical argument to someone who's just released a piece of software and has just tweeted, some bloke's selling it, that's not fair, because you can't sit them down for an hour and go through the philosophy of free software. Right, so I feel like what I'd like is for us to have a better way of explaining it. I just don't know whether we can have. And if we can't, then that's a problem, because more people are going to find this unfair and we're not going to be able to explain it.
So it sounds like your primary solution here will be trying to improve how we can educate and
yes.
discuss this with people. Jeremy, what would your approach be?
Yeah, I wish I had a pithy approach here, and I don't mean to sound jaded, but I think a lot of the issue here is like you're fighting the dynamics of humanity when you try to fix a problem like this, and that's typically very difficult to do, right? If there's an opportunity for someone to seek rents doing something like this, someone will do it eventually, regardless of how much you try to educate them. And I think education is important. And I think maybe that would disincentivize some people to do it.
Right.
But I think as far as actual real solutions to the problem, I cannot think of one offhand that is reasonable and I think would be super impactful, which is not a great answer, but is an honest answer.
Yeah.
So what's your...
So Jeremy's give up.
Normally what happens when Jono goes, I'm interested in people's solutions on this, is he's got a solution. So I'm sitting here in my chair waiting for it.
No. I mean, that's not fair. I have many solutions. I have a few ideas, almost all of which are certainly not going to work. One thing that's been interesting it's a side note, but it ties into this. Have you seen all this stuff that's been going on with a contributor covenant, the code of conduct style document? Have you seen that?
I don't know which things you're talking about that are going on with it.
But you know what the contributor covenant is, right? Yeah. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with this, it's kind of a prescribed set of, it's essentially a code of conduct, and a lot of projects have taken this on. A lot of people very familiar with the contributor covenant are going to yell at me now for saying it's not a code of conduct and I'm going to get it wrong, but that's broadly what it is. And what's been interesting is that it's really gotten a lot of steam in the last year or so, and it's become almost like a staple for how people are doing open source projects. Now, there are many views on that document, and I don't want to get into that, but it's almost like we need to have something similar, a principle that gets applied to how people procure software individually. So, you know, like how you go to the Google App Store or the Apple App Store, and that's where you get most of your software for your phone. It almost seems like there needs to be a marketplace where you can go and get VLC, where you can go and get this Minesweeper style thing. And by definition, it will support the project. So yes, you can go to eBay, and you'll never stop people being able to do that, but your education is really focused on not just on how people license their software and how they make it available, but you also almost like brand it around, here's how you ethically get it, right? In the same way that people have in recent years have become increasingly focused on ethical procurement of coffee that's grown properly and not using slave farmers and diamonds, not using blood diamonds and things like that. It almost seems like some form of channel like that. Now, that could either be branding, such as around like a partner style method, or it could be a single service, but that would be more difficult because if you want to use Android apps, for example, it'd be difficult to get that on your phone. But I think that is the solution to this. So,
you want an app store for Earth that's cross-platform across phones and desktops?
But that's the thing. I'm not so convinced that it will be a cross-platform. I think maybe the best solution here will be almost as like, you know, like
you mean,
how,
you mean a kite mark or something, something where
kind of like a kite mark.
Because there's no organization you could trust to actually manage and run the distribution channel. And even if there was one you could trust, you wouldn't get every platform.
Isn't that what the Ubuntu App Store is or the Google Play Store?
I think,
or...
John, correct me if I'm wrong here, but your thought is some organization says, we will give this the bacon seal of approval that this software is a good piece of software and the money goes back to the people who helped build it. And then you stamp that wherever that software shows up. So if it's on Android or iOS or whatever. So it's like a witch, the witch consumer mark of approval or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. In a similar way that, and there's these all over the place. I mean, like the Nintendo seal of approval is an example of this.
That is a mammoth project. I mean, that might work if you had an army of people putting it together.
Like in the same way that I won't donate any money at all to charity.
Stop there.
Unless I go to charity.
I'm just cutting that bit out and publishing it.
Like, unless I go to Charity Navigator and it performs well on Charity Navigator, it's not getting any money, right? But, like, that's, to me, that's the way in which I assess, is this a responsible organization that's going to use the donation properly? And it's almost seems like we need something like that. Now, it's tricky, and there's many layers to that onion, because you need to be able to make sure that, you know, somebody doesn't just stick that stamp on their website and then they just pocket the money. And you'd need to make sure that the project has a way of receiving the funds, which in itself, we haven't got into this, is a massive problem in open source, because a lot of projects can't do that. This is what the Linux Foundation Community Bridge is there to help with, where people can actually put money, or something like Linux Fund, I'm guessing, can be used for this. So that I can't think of any solution other than that that would actually reasonably solve it. So, but it is a massive undertaking.
Quite an undertaking. You have initiative. I look forward to the status update in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I look forward.
It will be done.
Well,
done.
Well, when you're CEO of this, if you want a CTO, you know who to call. A kite mark, or be better at bedside manner explanations, or despair.
Give up.
Which of these solutions do you think is right, listener? Let us know. Go to community.badvoltage.org and give us your thoughts.
Get in there. Let us know. And also, if you want to volunteer to do any of this stuff, go ahead, because we're not helping. This is the outro. We don't really have anything to say, but as I was saying to the other guys, it feels weird if we don't have an outro. So, and they think I'm ridiculous for saying this.
We also think it's ridiculous that you seem incapable of not putting the news first. It's perfectly reasonable
to go first. I don't know why. In the same way that whenever I take milk out of the fridge, I sniff it first. I don't make the rules. That's just the way it works. Okay.
Far more information than I needed about so many different things today.
All right, this was Bad Voltage. Bye, everyone.